Namaste. So, this evening, this morning, we take up chapter 17, The Progress to Knowledge, God, Man, and Nature. This was originally the 33rd chapter in the series of The Life Divine in the Arya. It has been substantially revised. We always begin with citations from the Vedanta or from the Veda. In the original, there were two citations from the Rig Veda, which have been dropped now in favor of Upanishadic and Vedantic selections. And you'll see that they focus carefully upon the larger perspective that Sri Aurobindo has, which he wishes to enforce here. The progress to knowledge, God, man, and nature, implying that knowledge will unify or synthesize these three terms of being. So he begins with, Thou art that, O Shweta Ketu, from the Chandogya Upanishad, one of the oldest Upanishads. Tattvam asi. You are that. So it begins with the authentic individual who is identical with that supreme reality. There is no difference. One is the same as the other. It does not say that there is no individual. It says that you, the individual, are that. Then he goes to the Viveka Chudamani, which is translated as the crest jewel of discrimination. Viveka is discrimination. This is a work that was composed by Shankaracharya, the great philosopher from, let's say, 8th century CE. And he says here, in Sri Aurobindo's translation, the living being is none else than the Brahman. The whole world is the Brahman. Brahmaiva jivaha sakalam jagatcha. Living being is the jiva, the individual. Jagat is the world. Both are Brahman. So here we have the individual and the universe, both identified with that supreme reality. The third citation is from the Bhagavad Gita, and he goes here to the 7th chapter. My supreme nature, para prakriti, has become the living being, jiva. And this world, idam jagat, is upheld, taryate, by it. All beings, sarvani bhutani, have this for their source, prabhava of birth. So here again, we situate both the individual and the world as realities inside the supreme nature of the divine being. Para prakriti, not the ordinary nature filled with ignorance. This is the supreme nature, which is the source of self and world. All beings have this for their source of birth. So even if we look at the external world and that ignorant lower prakriti, by assignation, they too come from that. As distant as they may seem, as imperfect as we may seem, all hail from that one supreme nature. Then he goes to the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, translated by Georg Feuerstein as the White Horsed One. I like that. That's a good way to translate that into English. It says, thou art man and woman. Boman, stri, boy and girl. Kumar, kumari. Old and worn, thou walkest bent over a staff. Dandena. Thou art the bluebird and the green and the scarlet-eyed. It bears to remember that the Shvetashvatara Upanishad is a late one, but also a theistic Upanishad, unusual to them. It's occurring late in the stream of the secret teachings, but focusing on a divine being who is a person as the originator of world and self. So this being is all of this. When he's talking here about the man and the woman, the boy and the girl, he goes beyond that, beyond the definitions of gender or age, and focuses on nature around as well. And then finally, continuing with the Shvetashvatara, just a few verses later, this whole world is filled with beings who are his members. So changing the view from the individual, everything that you see is that, but we're still looking at specific forms, names and forms, nama and rupa, of what is out there in the world. Now, he says, this whole world becomes a universal vision. Let's see. I think that covers Sarvam Idam Jagat. All the world, all in this world. So, now, I think you will find that this chapter is easier to understand than some of the early, more philosophic chapters. So you'll love the directness of his language here. An involution of the divine existence, the spiritual reality in the apparent inconscience of matter, is the starting point of the evolution. But that reality is in its nature an eternal existence, consciousness, delight of existence. The evolution must then be an emergence of this existence, consciousness, delight of existence, not at first in its essence or totality, but in evolutionary forms that express or disguise it. So in this first thing, an involution of the divine existence in the apparent inconscience of matter, connecting as he did when he discussed the sevenfold cord of being, that the supreme existence bases itself, conceals itself, as it were, in the foundation of matter, which in Sanskrit is anam. So sat conceals itself in anam. And of course, he's speaking here of Sat-Chit-Ananda. Out of the inconscient, existence appears in a first evolutionary form as substance of matter created by an inconscient energy. So here, if we look at the middle term of Sat-Chit-Ananda, at Chit, remember that Sri Aurobindo never separates in the origination of that term Chit from Shakti. They are synonymous. Consciousness is power. Power is conscious. Here, out of the inconscient, existence appears, created by an inconscient energy. So consciousness and power have been separated. This is the nature of the ignorance. the unity of Satchit Ananda is sacrificed for a few eons in the manifestation of the world. Consciousness, chit, involved and non-apparent in matter, first emerges in the disguise of vital vibrations, animate but subconscient, then in imperfect formulations of a conscient life. It strives towards self-finding through successive forms of that material substance, forms more and more adapted to its own completer expression. So he is now describing the general curve of evolution in flowing prose. So you can see that life begins to come forth and vibrate and animate matter, and then become somewhat aware of itself. Consciousness in life, throwing off the primal insensibility of a material inanimation and nescience, labors to find itself more and more entirely in the ignorance which is its first inevitable formulation. So, we must, by dint of the rules applied at the beginning of this cosmic game, start from ignorance, from nescience, and work our way back. But it achieves at first only a primary mental perception and a vital awareness of self and things, a life perception which, in its first forms, depends on an internal sensation responsive to the contacts of other life and of matter. So you can see, he's saying that life at this stage is outwardly aware and responsive primarily to external contacts. It is not looking into its inner experience and digesting and developing insight. Right now, it's trying to affirm and move and be safe. Consciousness labors to manifest as best it can, through the inadequacy of sensation, its own inherent delight of being, but it can only formulate a partial pain and pleasure. In man, the energizing consciousness appears as mind, more clearly aware of itself and things. This is still a partial and limited, not an integral power of itself, but a first conceptive potentiality and promise of integral emergence is visible. That integral emergence is the goal of evolving nature. Delight, the consummation of the play of the manifestation, where being and consciousness reunite in an unwalled delight. So he's just described the manifestation of life out of inert matter, and then the eventual limited luminescence of the mind as it appears. But we have to press beyond to arrive at this integrality, which is the secret aim of the cosmos. He continues, man is there to affirm himself in the universe. That is his first business, but also to evolve and finally to exceed himself. He has to enlarge his partial being into a complete being, his partial consciousness into an integral consciousness. He has to achieve mastery of his environment, but also world union and world harmony. He has to realize his individuality, but also to enlarge it into a cosmic self and a universal and spiritual delight of existence, a transformation a chastening and correction of all that is obscure, erroneous, and ignorant in his mentality, an ultimate arrival at a free and wide harmony and luminousness of knowledge and will and feeling and action and character is the evident intention of his nature. It is the ideal which the creative energy has imposed on his intelligence, a need implanted by her in his mental and vital substance. But this can only be accomplished by his growing into a larger being and a larger consciousness. Self-enlargement, self-fulfillment, self-evolution from what he partially and temporarily is in his actual and apparent nature, to what he completely is in his secret self and spirit, and therefore can become even in his manifest existence, is the object of his creation. This hope is the justification of his life upon earth amidst the phenomena of the cosmos. The outer apparent man, an ephemeral being, subject to the constraints of his material embodiment and imprisoned in a limited mentality, has to become the inner real man, master of himself and his environment, and universal in his being. In a more vivid and less metaphysical language, the natural man has to evolve himself into the divine man. The sons of death have to know themselves as the children of immortality. It is on this account that the human birth can be described as the turning point in the evolution, the critical stage in earth nature. So here we are called upon to recover our true conscious being, because it is through that that the wider integration can occur, that the fulfillment not only of the individual but the universalized individual can bring unity to the world, to all of its peoples, to all of its beings, and an overarching harmony can manifest here. If the human is willing to set aside the ego and live from the true being inside. So, it follows at once that the knowledge we have to arrive at is not truth of the intellect. It is not right belief, right opinions, right information about oneself and things. That is only the surface mind's idea of knowledge. To arrive at some mental conception about God and ourselves in the world is an object good for the intellect, but not large enough for the spirit. It will not make us the conscious sons of infinity. Ancient Indian thought meant by knowledge a consciousness which possesses the highest truth in a direct perception and in self-experience. To become, to be the highest that we know is the sign that we really have the knowledge. And go back to the beginning of this chapter, these great ringing verses taken from the stream of the Vedanta. Tattvamasi, you are that. All this nature is only that. Sarvam idam jagat. This is the basis of Indian wisdom. This recognition of the essential reality of self and world and what is beyond as being one. There is no ultimate division. There is manifestation, a making clear and overt what is held implicitly within. He continues, for the same reason, to shape our practical life, our actions, as far as may be in consonance with our intellectual notions of truth and right, or with a successful pragmatic knowledge, an ethical or a vital fulfillment, is not and cannot be the ultimate aim of our life. Our aim must be to grow into our true being, our being of spirit, the being of the supreme and universal existence, consciousness, delight, Satchit-Ananda. All our existence depends on that existence. It is that which is evolving in us. We are a being of that existence, a state of consciousness of that consciousness, an energy of that conscious energy, a will to delight of being, delight of consciousness, delight of energy born of that delight. This is the root principle of our existence. But our surface formulation of these things is not that. It is a mistranslation into the terms of the ignorance, but one which he has averred earlier was necessary to the play of the cosmos. Let's not regret it. Let's simply go forward and recover the truth of our real being. No need repining about the nature of the world around us. The key to its perfection and redemption lies inside of us. Our I, he writes, is not that spiritual being which can look on the divine existence and say, that am I. Our mentality is not that spiritual consciousness. Our will is not that force of consciousness. Our pain and pleasure, even our highest joys and ecstasies, are not that delight of being. And here he's speaking to our current state, our current embarrassment in a mortal frame, having forgotten that which we are and must recover. But we have to take it as the practical fact of our being, moving from darkness and ignorance back to light and knowledge. On the surface, we are still an ego, figuring self, and ignorance turning into knowledge, a will laboring towards true force, a desire seeking for the delight of existence. To become ourselves by exceeding ourselves, so we may turn the inspired phrases of a half-blind seer who knew not the self of which he spoke, Friedrich Nietzsche, is the difficult and dangerous necessity, the cross surmounted by an invisible crown which is imposed on us, the riddle of the true nature of his being proposed to man by the dark sphinx of the inconscience below, and from within and above by the luminous veiled sphinx of the infinite consciousness and eternal wisdom confronting him as an inscrutable divine Maya. So, the riddle above is the riddle below. The Sphinx, who represents the power of manifestation, the inscrutable Shakti, is dark and tenebrous when seen from the view of the inconscient, if it has a view, quite different when seen from its superconscient origination. To exceed ego and be our true self, to be aware of our real being, to possess it, to possess a real delight of being, is therefore the ultimate meaning of our life here. It is the concealed sense of our individual and terrestrial existence. So again, we are key to the cosmos. Intellectual knowledge and practical action are devices of nature by which we are able to express so much of our being, consciousness, energy, power of enjoyment, as we have been able to actualize in our apparent nature, and by which we attempt to know more, express and actualize more, grow always more into the much that we have yet to actualize. But our intellect and mental knowledge and will of action are not our only means, not all the instruments of our consciousness and energy. Our nature, the name which we give to the force of being in us in its actual and potential play and power, is complex in its ordering of consciousness, complex in its instrumentation of force. The Chit Shakti, as it manifests. Every discovered or discoverable term and circumstance of that complexity which we can get into working order, we need to actualize in the highest and finest values possible to us, and to use in its widest and richest powers for the one object. That object is to become, to be conscious, to increase continually in our realized being and awareness of self and things, in our actualized force and joy of being, and to express that becoming dynamically in such an action on the world and ourselves that we and it shall grow more and always yet more towards the highest possible reach, largest possible breadth of universality and infinity. Beautifully phrased, and it is Vedic in its inspiration. All man's age-long effort, his action, society, art, ethics, science, religion, all the manifold activities by which he expresses and increases his mental, vital, physical, spiritual existence are episodes in the vast drama of this endeavor of nature, and have behind their limited apparent aims no other true sense or foundation. For the individual to arrive at the divine universality and supreme infinity, live in it, possess it, to be, know, feel, and express that alone in all his being, consciousness, energy, delight of being, is what the ancient seers of the Veda meant by the knowledge. That was the immortality which they set before man as his divine culmination. But by the nature of his mentality, by his inlook into himself and his outlook on the world, by his original limitation in both through sense and body to the relative, the obvious and the apparent, man is obliged to move step by step, and at first obscurely and ignorantly, in this immense evolutionary movement. It is not possible for him to envisage being at first in the completeness of its unity. It presents itself to him through diversity, and his search for knowledge is preoccupied with three principal categories which sum up for him all its diversity: himself, man or individual soul, God, and nature. This is the familiar transcendence, universality, and individuality, which has recurred in earlier chapters. So he'll go from the near to the far, now from the individual to the universal and the transcendent as he progresses in his argument here. The first is that of which alone he is directly aware in his normal ignorant being, He sees himself, the individual, separate apparently in its existence, yet always inseparable from the rest of being, striving to be sufficient, yet always insufficient to itself. Sense, never has it been known to come into existence or to exist or to culminate in its existence apart from the rest. Without their aid and independently of universal being and universal nature, the individual is ensconced in nature and cannot exist outside its universal context. This is the way in which the Supreme has manifested itself. This egoistic ideal of an ego which is a rock, which is an island separate from all others, is an absurdity. As John Donne said, no man is an island entire unto itself. Each man is a piece of the continent, a part of the whole. Secondly, there is that which he knows only indirectly by his mind and bodily senses and its effects upon them, yet must strive always to know more and more completely. For he sees also this rest of being with which he is so closely identified and yet from which he is so separate, the cosmos, world, nature, other individual existences whom he perceives as always like himself and yet always unlike. For they are the same in nature, even to the plant and the animal, and yet different in nature. Each seems to go its own way, to be a separate being, and yet each is impelled by the same movement and follows in its own grade the same vast curve of evolution as himself. Finally, he sees, or rather divines, something else, which he does not know at all except quite indirectly, for he knows it only through himself. And that at which his being aims through the world, and that at which it seems to point, and which it is either striving obscurely to reach and express by its imperfect figures, or, at least, founds them without knowing it on their secret relation to that invisible reality and occult infinite. In other words, the unknown Godhead. This third and unknown, this tertium quid, or tertium quid, if you prefer, he names God. That just means a third something. And by the word, he means somewhat or someone, so either impersonal or personal. He means somewhat or someone who is the supreme, the divine, the cause, the all, one of these things or all of them at once, the perfection or the totality of all that here is partial or imperfect, the absolute of all these myriad relativities, the unknown by learning of whom the real secret of the known can become to him more and more intelligible, like the Mundaka Upanishad 1.1.3. Knowing that by which all is known. Man has tried to deny all these categories. He has tried to deny his own real existence. He has tried to deny the real existence of the cosmos. He has tried to deny the real existence of God. But behind all these denials, we see the same constant necessity of his attempt at knowledge. For he feels the need of arriving at a unity of these three terms, even if it can only be done by suppressing two of them or merging them in the other that is left. To do that, he affirms only himself as cause and all the rest as mere creations of his mind, Or he affirms only nature and all the rest as nothing but phenomena of nature energy. Or he affirms only God, the Absolute, and all the rest as no more than illusions which that thrusts upon itself or on us by an inexplicable Maya. Three distinct philosophical positions, none of them, as he has examined them in the past chapters, is complete, or can they satisfy the ultimate thirst of the human for a greater knowledge. None of these denials can wholly satisfy, none solves the entire problem or can be indisputable and definitive, least of all the one to which his sense-governed intellect is most prone, but in which it can never persist for long. The denial of God is a denial of his true quest and his own supreme ultimate. The ages of naturalistic atheism have always been short-lived because they can never satisfy the secret knowledge in man. That cannot be the final Veda because it does not correspond with the Veda within, which all mental knowledge is laboring to bring out. From the moment that this lack of correspondence is felt, a solution, however skillful it may be, and however logically complete, has been judged by the eternal witness in man and is doomed. It cannot be the last word of knowledge. So if the first word of knowledge in recovering our own real being is, you are that, then it strips away the permissibility, the usability of this materialism. It is doomed, Sri Aurobindo says, with the resurgence of a real knowledge from inside. Our insight, our experience of a transcendent reality makes it impossible to accept, ultimately, that the formulas and the figurings of a superficial nature are all that it is, that molecular collisions can describe for us the emergence of the psyche from within. So, man as he is not sufficient to himself, nor separate, nor is he the eternal and the all. Therefore, by himself, he cannot be the explanation of the cosmos of which his mind, life, and body are so evidently an infinitesimal detail. The visible cosmos, too, he finds, is not sufficient to itself, nor does it explain itself even by its unseen material forces. For there is too much that he finds both in the world and in himself which is beyond them, and of which they seem only to be a face, an epidermis, and even a mask. Neither his intellect, nor his intuitions, nor his feeling can do without a one or a oneness to whom or to which these world forces and himself may stand in some relation which supports them and gives them their significance. He feels that there must be an infinite which holds these finites, is in, behind, and about all this visible cosmos, bases the harmony and interrelation and essential oneness of multitudinous things. And this calls forth those lines from the Mundaka Upanishad, where Brahman is described as being within, around, above, behind, below, everywhere one turns the piercing view of an opened consciousness, one finds and meets only this same conscious reality, already there waiting for you to see it. He feels, Sri Aurobindo continues here, that there must be an infinite which holds these finites, I'm sorry, I've read that, is in, behind, and about all this visible cosmos, bases the harmony and interrelation and essential oneness of multitudinous things. His thought needs an absolute on which these innumerable and finite relativities depend for their existence, an ultimate truth of things, a creating power or force, or a being who originates and upholds all these innumerable beings in the universe. Back to the opening citations to the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Let him call it what he will. He must arrive at a supreme, a divine, a cause, an infinite and eternal, a permanent, a perfection to which all tends and aspires, or an all to which everything perpetually and invisibly amounts, and without which they could not be. So, from his view, both individual and universe fail without an all-embracing and an all-reconciling Godhead in which they can found themselves and find themselves. Let us put our bookmark there. I think we'll be able to finish this chapter in 3 sessions, so we'll continue with the middle portion next time in early May. Tonight we roll back to Savitri. This is from Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 11, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Mind. The cosmos is no accident in time. There is a meaning in each play of chance. There is a freedom in each face of fate. A wisdom knows and guides the mysteried world. A truth gaze shapes its beings and events. A word self-born upon creation's heights, voice of the eternal in the temporal spheres, prophet of the seeings of the absolute, sows the idea's significance and form, and from that seed the growths of time arise. On peaks beyond our ken, the all-wisdom sits. A single and infallible look comes down. A silent touch from the supernal's air awakes to ignorant knowledge in its acts, the secret power in the inconscient depths, compelling the blinded Godhead to emerge, determining necessity's new dance as she passes through the circuit of the hours and vanishes from the chase of finite eyes down circling vistas of aeonic time. The unseizable forces of the cosmic whirl bear in their bacchant limbs the fixity of an original foresight that is fate. Even nature's ignorance is truth's instrument. Our struggling ego cannot change her course. Yet is it a conscious power that moves in us. A seed idea is parent of our acts, and destiny, the unrecognized child of will. Infallibly, by truth's directing gaze, all creatures here their secret self disclose, forced to become what in themselves they hide. For he who is grows manifest in the years, and the slow Godhead shut within the cell climbs from the plasm to immortality. But hidden, but denied to mortal grasp, mystic, ineffable is the Spirit's truth, unspoken, caught only by the Spirit's eye. When naked of ego and mind, it hears the voice. It looks through light to ever greater light and sees eternity in sphering life. This greater truth is foreign to our thoughts. Where a free wisdom works, they seek for a rule, or we only see a tripping game of chance or a labor in chains forced by bound nature's law, an absolutism of dumb, unthinking power. So, thank you. Namaste. Jai Ma.